I'm going to introduce the next topic and our speaker, Larry Smith, a FASB board member. A little background. At the July SAG meeting, we had some discussion about the volume and pace of the standards. In the October SAG meeting, we focused on a few specific standards. The end of January, the FASB comment period closed on the effective date and transition methods discussion paper. And today, Larry is going to talk a little bit about on the update on the FASB standard setting agenda, the implications of the volume of things that they're facing, and some of the changes going on with the different standards. And appreciate Larry coming here today. I've known Larry for quite a few years. He's the one, many of you know that I used to be an EITF member. I remember it was about 4.5 years ago that Larry called me and said, Jay, do you want to be an EITF member? I'd express the interest, and I said sure. And so we've commiserated long and hard about lots of things in the EITF and other things, including the codification that Larry was instrumental in. So I will turn it over to Larry for about 20 minutes of formal presentation, and we'll fire away some questions at him. So go ahead, Larry.
Thanks, Jay. And the EITF's loss is the PCAOB's gain, so good luck. Slide two, I'm sorry, I have to, the remote didn't work from this distance, so I'm going to have to tell you when to switch. But slide two is the typical disclaimer, so these are my views, only my views, and not those of the FASB, et cetera. What I'd like to do, as Jay indicated, is provide a little overview of where we are, what our objectives are, what things look like in the near term in terms of the various projects that are on our agenda and where they sit, and then talk about what we refer to now as the big four standards that we're working on with the IASB, and touch upon some of the issues that I raised in July, I guess it was, and issues relating to increased auditor judgment and how we've addressed some of those issues in redeliberations. This slide here really just is a general overview of what we're really trying to accomplish as we work on specific standards with the IASB. And very simply, you know, we're trying to take existing U.S. GAAP and improve the standards and converge them. The IASB is trying to take their standards under IFRS and improve them and come up with a high-quality global set of accounting standards. The next slide, however, touches upon how we deal with this, because part of the struggle at the FASB, and I'm sure at the IASB, is how do we come up with a converged set of high-quality standards, and do we sacrifice what we think is a high-quality decision for the sake of convergence or not? And the FASB members struggled with this for a while and finally decided on a hierarchy, which our Board of Trustees agreed with, and that is that our priorities in standard setting and working with the IASB should be as follows. First and foremost, that we should maintain our independent due process, all right? To the extent that situations provoke us or might provoke us to shortcut the method or what have you, we feel we should step back and say, you know something, we can't go there. We need to maintain our independent due process. The second priority is to improve financial reporting in the United States. Okay, so to the extent that we have decisions and we feel that certain decisions just are not an improvement in financial reporting in the U.S. or are not implementable because of certain specific reasons, that we should fall back to really assessing what the impact is on the U.S. And then finally, the third item is to reach consistent answers with the with IFRS. So that's the hierarchy that we try to keep in mind as we make decisions. Next slide. I will not talk at this time on the four that are in pink or orange or whatever color that is, because those are what we consider to be the big four. That's where we are spending the bulk of our time right now in deliberations with the IASB, and I can tell you that those deliberations are ongoing practically 3, sometimes 4 days a week from now until I'm not sure exactly when. We are in an extremely accelerated mode that I don't think standard setting has seen before. That being said, and I know there's significant concern in this room, outside this room, about the pace of change and the pace with which both we and the IASB are addressing these standards. And you read a lot, particularly when Sir David is being quoted, about the June 30th deadline, et cetera. The FASB continues to view June 30th as a target date for getting these projects done. We do not plan to make any decisions or shortcut any analysis that's necessary in order to achieve a June 30th date, but it still remains a target. One thing that people can feel comfortable with is if we were able to reach June 30th with all our substantive decisions and actually, let's say, publish staff drafts of new standards for these four projects, the FASB still has to take those agreed upon standards and convert them into a codification, changes to the codification. And we have committed that we will expose those changes to the codification. So if best of all worlds in terms of dealing with these issues, if we came up with those standards, post June 30th, our staff would have to go through and make the required changes or proposed changes to the codification. We would then expose them so everybody knows what the consequential effects of our decisions are. And there are times through that process that we learn some things. And to the extent that we learn some things, I guarantee you that we would not ignore them. So that's just something that would be coming down the pike if we were to meet certain targets. Real quickly, I'm going to try to bring you up to speed with where we are on some of these issues on this slide. Consolidation, we had issued 167 more than a year ago. The IASB then took the principles of 167 and effectively incorporated it into a principle consolidation model that really was applicable to both variable interest entities as well as voting interest entities. They exposed it and then started to re-deliberate. We re-deliberated with them and came up with a series of decisions. And they then formed a staff draft, which was very close to a final. What we did was we exposed that last fall, I guess it was, to see what how U.S. constituents would view it, because there was one fundamental difference in that consolidation standard versus what we have, and it pertains to voting interest entities. As you all know, we kind of have a 50.1% voting interest model in terms of having control. They have an effective control notion, which enables you to consolidate somebody if you have control but are holding less than 50% of the shares. We exposed it and received very negative reaction from both the user and the preparer and auditor communities here in the U.S. We held a roundtable in December. The views expressed by people that responded were very consistent with the views that were presented back in the mid-90s when Denny and his crew exposed something similar to that. So we were not surprised. We reported those results of our outreach here in the U.S. to the IASB to see whether they wanted to change their mind or change their proposed standard at all. And they decided that they did not want to change it. So here we are. That kind of put the ball on our court as to what we wanted to do. And we said, well, we really don't want to change U.S. GAAP now to reflect the change in the voting interest model. So that's where we are with respect to consolidations. Discontinued operations, there's both the IASB and the FASB have agreed to change the definition to effectively take the evaluation of a discontinued operation up to a higher level. And we plan on issuing an exposure draft, I believe, in the second quarter of this year. Emissions trading, we have really postponed any further deliberations of emissions trading until we get through with the Big Four, so I don't anticipate anything coming out in the near term. Our tech plan says, and it, some type of a document to be exposed in the fourth quarter, that might be a little optimistic in my view. Financial instruments with characteristics of equity. Basically, the IASB and the FASB exposed a document that did not receive very positive feedback. We went back to the drawing board to see if we could pull ourselves together a little bit closer. At the end of the day, the IASB really didn't want to change their model all that much, so we kind of put it on hold and said, well, let's wait until the Big Four are done to see what we want to do. My take is that the IASB probably doesn't want to move very far off of the model that they have. Whether we want to make certain, let's say, tweaks to our model to try to deal with some of the specific implementation issues that exist remains to be seen. The difficulty is that there it really, using the fundamental model we have now, results in a fairly rules-based system that's fairly complicated. The SEC is, this is still an area where there are significant restatements, particularly among the smaller public companies, and I sense that that might just be because the larger firms have their subject matter experts, and when there's a liabilities and equity issue, it goes to them and they can deal with the issue, and sometimes the smaller firms don't have that breadth of experience, and it's not that anybody's trying to do anything wrong, it's just that they are very complicated standards. I have been somewhat on a, I don't want to say a war path, but I've tried to encourage us to do something at least as it pertains to the codification, because if you try to read the codified financial instruments with characteristics of equity section, it's almost illegible. I mean, and it really is a function of the fact that it took a bunch of pieces of literature and put them together, and I'd like at a minimum for us to at least rewrite that so we have a starting point and something that people can understand. Financial statement presentation, really we completed some outreach on our staff draft. At the end of the day, we have a lot of good feedback, and we've kind of just put that on the shelf and said, okay, once we have some more time, let's consider that feedback. Maybe it's a full-blown project on financial statement presentation as it was. Maybe it's taking pieces of it and breaking them off into smaller projects. Not sure, but we have a lot of good feedback in terms of how to move forward once we get through the issues we're dealing with. Fair value measurement, there'll be a final amendment to 157 coming out very shortly. There's a ballot draft on my desk back in the office. Most of these changes, we believe, are fairly minor, and really, unfortunately, they look major because we changed a lot of words so that the IASB's version of 157 and our version are almost identically written. But that will be coming out shortly. And I think that's it on that slide. Next slide, please. Okay, now on FASB-only projects, troubled debt restructurings, there'll be an ED coming out within a couple of weeks at most, which basically provides some interpretive guidance into how to determine what is and what is not a troubled debt restructuring, because with the increase in restructurings, there's been some diversity in terms of how people are interpreting those words. Disclosure of certain loss contingencies, we kind of put that on hold last fall when we found out that our second exposure draft didn't receive quite as much positive feedback as we were hoping it would. And really, we're waiting. There have been a number of letters that have gone out from the SEC emphasizing the need to make robust disclosures under FAS 5 with respect to contingencies. We're waiting to see the results of that. I can tell you that in looking at some of the large financial institution disclosures, there have been some increases in disclosures that weren't there previously. So it will be interesting to see the SEC's assessment of it, and then we'll make a determination as to whether we think this is really an implementation issue with respect to FAS 5 or whether we think we need to do something else. Disclosures about an employer's participation in multi-employer plan. The major problem or the major criticism of our proposal with respect to that, because companies that participate in multi-employer plans do not have a lot of disclosure regarding those plans. The major complaint was about the requirement to disclose the withdrawal liability. People are saying that that's really an irrelevant measurement and therefore shouldn't be disclosed, and we're working with people that actively participate in multi-employer plans to come up with some alternative disclosures. Investment properties is really a project to consider whether we should require fair value measurement for companies that invest in real estate investments primarily. It's kind of a convergence project because really the IASB has an option that allows people to account for these at fair value, at which if you do account for a fair value, it takes you out of the proposed leasing standard we have, and the real estate properties in the U.S. are basically asking if they can do the same thing. We're in the process of looking at it. There aren't very many board members that support an option in the U.S., and now we're trying to work through details to effectively get something similar to the IASB but not have it as an option. The disclosure framework is a relook at disclosures in general. I can tell you the staff is working on it, but there's nothing that will be coming out shortly on it. Disclosures about risks and uncertainties in the liquidation base of accounting, which previously we referred to as the Going Concern Project, started with the codification, really. And really what we were going to do was take a cut and paste of the going concern literature and the auditing literature and put it into the accounting literature. The project has taken on a life of its own such that it's really gravitated to something that we consider less to be a consideration of going concern and more to be a project about what disclosures should companies be making as their ability to continue as a going concern becomes more questionable. So it's a little bit like the risk and uncertainties, SOP, I don't know, 94.6 or whatever number it is. In terms of its flavor, as Marty indicated before, we have been working with both the SEC staff and the PCAOB to try to reflect their comments. We have a staff draft, and I think we have some future meetings among the PCAOB staff and the SEC staff to talk about it further. This is an interesting one. It's something that should be very relevant to the extent that we go forward with it to this group because there are major implications in terms of the qualitative statements that companies are expected to make and at what point in time they are expected to make those qualitative statements. So this is, an area of increased judgment on the part of both companies and auditors. And goodwill impairment assessments came onto our agenda really as a private company matter. Private companies were very concerned with the amount of time they spend doing fair value assessments for goodwill impairment assessments, and we looked at whether we can come up with some qualitative assessments that would be less costly than a fair value assessment to evaluate goodwill impairments. We've since decided that we'll expose a document and it will relate to or be applicable to both public and private companies, because this is not just a private company issuer. Okay, next slide. Thank you. In terms of the transition and effective date discussion paper, I think Marty or somebody mentioned that the exposure period ended a little while ago. We received roughly 120 or so comment letters. The ISB received about 150. Some of the feedback was to be expected, and that is that implementation is going to be pretty costly and time-consuming, that some of our proposals in RevRec and leases, et cetera, will have a broader impact on business in terms of, tax arrangements, regulatory arrangements, borrowing arrangements, et cetera. And a number of people have supported earlier application. Next slide. In terms of views that are different, the implementation approach, meaning whether you implement these in a single date versus a sequential Chinese water torture type of approach. Interestingly enough, the IFRS constituency basically supports a single date. And I think if you look at it, to the extent that it's European-driven, Europe adopted IFRS all at once. So, therefore, a big bang to them doesn't seem to be that big of a deal. In terms of the FASB responses, basically it's split, roughly 60-40 or what have you. So I'm not sure exactly how we'll evaluate that, and it will be nice to hear your views. The document goes through the various transition methods that at least provisionally were being recommended for the various projects. I think for the most part, the IASB type respondents supported what was in the document. The views of U.S. constituents were much less supportive of some of those implementation methods. Okay, next slide. All right, now what I'd like to do is just address some of the items that I highlighted as key judgmental areas in the July meeting and talk about what we've done. In terms of the project on financial instruments, skipping down to the third one, core deposits at current value or some notion of current value, we've since decided that we'll basically keep deposits at what they are today, cost plus accrued interest. The liabilities amortized cost exception really goes away with our decision that we would basically record our liabilities at amortized cost. Liabilities other than derivative type liabilities, that is. We have not changed the no probable threshold in terms of impairment, so still there will be no threshold like there is today under U.S. GAAP. And the last two items we have not addressed. Many of you hopefully are aware of the fact that impairment seems to be really the key area where there's at least an opportunity for a greater opportunity for the FASB and the IASB to get on the same page. The problem is the IASB and the FASB are looking at impairment very differently. Our starting points are almost opposite ends of the spectrum, and what we came out with was a proposal to basically introduce some of the concepts in the IASB's view of impairment, some of the concepts in the FASB's view on impairment, put them together as really a compromise. And the supplemental document that we put on our websites basically indicates that this is a result of a compromise. And right now we're out talking to people to see what their views are, whether this is implementable or what have you. Thus far, it's interesting. This is a very geographic issue. The people that we talk to overseas understand the IASB's part of it, and they don't understand our part of it, which is, that you should record a reserve based upon the losses you expect in the foreseeable future. They don't understand the concept of foreseeable future, et cetera. And the U.S. constituents that we talk to don't understand the time proportionate amount that represents the IASB's piece of it. So, effectively, we've confused everybody in the world. Except. It seems like there is support from the banking regulators. Next slide. In terms of revenue recognition, we've made a number of decisions on this project, and I think if you go through it, you'll see that we've taken the comments seriously, but yet we're still struggling with some of them. Yesterday is a perfect example. We dealt with the concept of contingent consideration, so variable payments under a revenue plan, and had to deal with that. We had a discussion for 4 hours on three different papers, and we reached absolutely no decisions whatsoever, which might cause some people to pause when they think about the June 30th target date. But I think we've done a lot in terms of when to combine and separate contracts. I think when you take a look at some of the concerns that were expressed about revenue recognition for service contracts in particular, and people not understanding the notion of transfer of control as it pertains to service contract, I think you'll see that I believe we've effectively dealt with them, and we're out talking to the construction industry, et cetera, to see if they agree with our assessment that we've kind of dealt with some of their issues. So hopefully in RevRec we're headed towards something, although contingent consideration is something that remains. In terms of leases, we've dealt with a number of the issues. Some of them were, you know, options to renew or cancel, where effectively you'd have to look at all of your potential options in the future. Now we've basically said, instead of that, if there's, it's basically a model similar to what we have today, and that is, if you have a significant economic incentive, then you should consider those as a part of your lease obligation and your lease asset. If not, then you don't have to. And in terms of reconsideration events, you really just have to assess whether there are events or circumstances that have occurred to cause you to reassess. So, for example, if I have a lease, 3 years left on a lease with an option to renew, and I go out and put a significant leasehold improvement, that might create a significant economic incentive for me to renew that lease. Contingent rents, we've also changed the threshold for assessing contingent rents, and really, you know, under the decisions we've made, basically you would have a probability or a high probability threshold for considering contingent rents. That was not the case in the ED. Separating leases from service, we're still working on that. We're really looking at the indicators of value to assess the service components. So to the extent that you can figure out that if you have a lease with a certain service related to it, you look to the marketplace to try to determine that component of the lease agreement, and that would not be considered a part of the amount that you would capitalize, because there was a lot of feedback that we were capitalizing too many executory type arrangements in the proposed lease standard. I say that's about it. I mean, I think a number of the significant judgmental areas have been addressed, but yet I'm not going to sit here and say that there isn't a lot of judgment still going to be required, but I think we've gone a long way to helping people. I found it interesting this morning that when you started, I think it was Barbara that indicated the increased amount of judgment that exists in accounting standards, and I think the implication at least was that maybe we need to go tone that down a little bit and go back to something that is quote-unquote more auditable or what have you. And it really sounded like the principle-based versus rule-based discussion was going to start all over again. So I wasn't quite certain about that. Anyway, Jay.
Larry, thanks. Thanks for your presentation. We're going to let SAG members ask questions of Larry, And well, before we get into the briefing topics that were in the briefing paper, and while SAG members are formulating their questions for Larry, let me just start off with one you touched at the beginning of your presentation about the four projects. And I note, like on revenue, leases, and financial instruments, the boards in their redeliberations have made a number of changes. And you had alluded to a commitment as you get to June 30 to re-expose in terms of the codification. And I guess the question is, some of the changes you've made in the projects have been in response to comment letters. Others have been in response to convergence issues. But am I understanding you correctly that when you get to June 30, is there the possibility of re-exposing, for example, on a standalone basis, revenue recognition for some of these issues that you mentioned that you talked about even yesterday? Or what are your thoughts on re-exposure of the exposure drafts as opposed to exposure of the codification as we get to the June 30 deadline?
Okay, well, any decision to re-expose a standard is usually made when you've completed your redeliberations. So I think it would be too early for me to specifically comment on my views about re-exposure of a proposed standard. That being said, let's assume that we decided not to re-expose revenue recognition, for example. The exposure of the codification amendments would be done from the perspective that we would want people to reflect upon whether we made the appropriate amendments to the codification that reflect the decisions made in the standard and whether we had captured them all. So that's the context in which the exposure of the codification would be made. That being said, we would have to also at least make available to people the full-blown revenue recognition standard so people would be able to evaluate whether the codification amendments were appropriate. And I can tell you based upon my experience that even when you try to lead people to what they should be commenting on and saying, please only reflect on the codification amendments, we might receive a comment or two on the basic decisions. So, and to the extent that those comments cause us to pause, you know, I can't predict what would happen.
Okay, thanks.
Hopefully I wasn't too subtle in my...
I appreciate the answer. I want to open up the floor to questions. I have to note I did promise Larry that, similar to our July meeting, that we would try and focus the questions on the judgment issues and the auditability issues as opposed to particular comments or criticisms on the accounting model. And with that, let me recognize Jay Hansen, who has a question.
Larry, I appreciate the slide that you had talking about the guideposts for these convergence projects of open, transparent process, getting the U.S. Interest first, and then converging as number three. And I know your chairman, Leslie Seidman, has made some comments recently at a speech about it was the impairment model, for example, that effectively that we're not going to converge for the sake of converging if we don't agree. And yet at the same speech, Sir David was emphatic about the need for movement to IFRS and the fracturing of the global coalition to get there. It's a huge elephant in the room, obviously. Do you have any personal thoughts? I realize you can't speak for the board, but personal thoughts on where you think this is going to go?
I'm pausing because I really don't know.
That's fair. All of us are raising those same questions.
You know, I can tell you that we're at the point that we are board members could not work harder than they're working right now. Staff members definitely could not work harder than they are right now. And we all feel badly that we're pushing our staff like we are, because I think, you know, not only our staff, but constituents. I mean, I think Marty and others have made the point that people are having difficulty keeping up with us, and I can totally understand that. At the same time, I think it's important for the FASB to demonstrate that it's doing its best to try to come up with a set of high-quality converged standards and not be viewed in the eyes of the world as being the laggards that just can't deal with it. However, our goal is to issue standards that are implementable with a minimum amount of implementation guidance required subsequent to the effective dates of those standards. And if we don't feel we're there because we didn't have the time, because we, you know, some things came up through discussions with constituents as we make decisions, then as far as the FASB is concerned, and I'm talking for myself, but I know that all of the board members have the same view, we're not going to come up with those, you know, finalize something if we feel that there are fatal flaws in it, you know, when we reach that day. So we're trying our best, but at the same time, we're sticking by our guns in terms of accomplishing those objectives in terms of the priority that I set out. But I can't predict it, Jay.
Barbara Roper.
Since you commented on my earlier comment, I wanted to clarify a point. This was not actually an attempt to reintroduce the issues of principles versus rules-based, but to suggest that if one of the reasons that audits of financial institutions in the recent crisis were so unhelpful in identifying problems is that more of the issues that are covered by the audits are subjective or judgment-based or qualitative, and auditors currently aren't necessarily doing a very good job of that, and I started this sentence with an if, then we need to understand that, and the PCAOB needs to understand that. They need to understand what, if anything, can be done to improve the quality of audits related to judgments and principles and subjective standards. And then I would suggest as a second point that to the degree that the PCAOB finds that certain accounting standards are unauditable, there needs to be a fairly formal input from the PCAOB into FASB. But so it's not an issue to refight an old debate, but simply to learn from recent experience so that we can make sure this process works better if this is the world, if this is the direction that we're moving in. But I would add a second point on the issues of principles-based regulation, which is that industry support for principles-based regulation evaporates quickly in an environment when someone suggests that they might be held accountable for complying with a principle. And that part of what has been lacking in the financial crisis is any willingness to hold people accountable for, so far, in any transparent way, for things, conduct that looks highly questionable. So if we are going to move in this direction, I also think it needs to be backed by a much greater willingness on the part of regulators at the SEC and the PCAOB to hold people accountable for how they comply with those principles, judgment-based standards.
Larry, did you have a response to that?
No.
Okay, that's fine. One of the things I wanted to respond, Barbara, you know, Jim and Marty had noted our increased efforts in working with the SEC and FASB, and one of the things that the foundation that oversees the FASB is started, as you may be aware, is this post-implementation review of the proposed standards. And part of those efforts that Jim and Marty alluded to is the PCAOB staff involvement with that post-implementation review, so that in terms of, you know, what we're seeing in inspections, that type of information, you know, we'll be communicating with the FASB and the SEC. So just wanted to.
And I think that's great. And I would just say some pre-implementation review. I mean, once you're at post-implementation, you're a little late in the process. If there are issues you can identify earlier on that are likely to be problematic, that past experience in other areas indicate are likely to be problematic, we would hope that that input is being provided in the front end as well. But I think it's terrific, the kind of feedback that you are getting into the process.
The FASB provides us with fatal flaw reviews, and we monitor their process. So it is both pre and post. So next, Denny Beresford.
Larry, we have a separate agenda paper dealing with disclosures, and it refers to two separate proposals outstanding right now, one on revenue recognition and one on derivatives. And just to quote real briefly, the revenue recognition says that an entity shall consider the level of detail necessary to satisfy the disclosure requirements and how much emphasis to place on each of the various requirements. In other words, make a judgment as to how much you think should be disclosed. And the other one has a similar one, determine in light of facts and circumstances how much detail it should be required to disclose. That's quite a different approach, I think, than the FASB has typically taken in the past. First of all, is this something that the FASB has sort of chosen as a new approach to disclosure requirements? And secondly, can you recall any reaction that you may have received, at least to the revenue recognition? I think you probably haven't received the comments much on the on the second one yet.
those general words, it's kind of interesting. I think we kind of took from an existing IFRS disclosure requirement, and we've tended to put in words similar to that in a couple of proposed standards where we say, you know, give us enough detail so that people can understand it, but don't give us so much detail that you're obscuring the facts. You know, and Bob Herz, when he was chairman, used to like to call it the, not too much, not too little, just right type of thing. And I guess what we're trying to do is while we prescribe specific things that should be disclosed, it's difficult for us to prescribe the level at which those details get disclosed. And we've been, you know, woefully criticized for requiring too much disclosures and the fact that financial statements now are people need a scale to weigh the size of these financial statements, et cetera. So we try to put that in as a general framework for people to evaluate whether they're, you know, just going overboard in terms of this disclosure or not going far enough. Whether it's helpful or not, I mean, I don't really know. We haven't seen the results of people trying to implement it and whether that phrase is causing difficulty in terms of preparers dealing with their auditors and auditors challenging their clients. So in terms of the specific reaction, I think we've received some mixed reaction. I think people have expressed some concern similar to the one you're asking about, and that is, you know, who's to make this determination? And we do have a separate project on disclosure, the disclosure framework. But again, that I can tell you that the staff has struggled with that because they've gone back. Initially, when they started the Disclosure Framework project, they went back to the very fundamentals of the conceptual framework in general, and that is, you know, what's relevant information, et cetera. And, you know, the board struggled with it, and we scratched our heads saying, you know, I don't know how people are going to use this. So I...
I didn't necessarily mean to imply a position, and I'll save that for later in the day. But it really does kind of raise the fundamental question of both judgment and principles versus rules.
Exactly.
And I was just curious as to what kind of reaction you were getting in comment letters, and then down the road, obviously, it will be a real question as far as both auditability and inspections and so forth.
Yeah, I agree.
Mike Gallagher.
Larry, I just wanted to first, you know, commend the FASB board. I think we've come a long way since last July, when I think you got an earful. You know, it's one of the few things I think there was a consensus on at the SAG where it was just too much. So I think you deserve high marks for listening and scaling back. I think the commitment to quality and stating the commitment to quality and then having that supported by the actions that you took in terms of coming down to a manageable, you know, number of exposure graphs on the key issues, I think, was really key. And the changes that you made, I think, to the existing exposure graphs, financial instruments, revenue, and leasing, I think have also been very positive in recognizing the practical without sacrificing quality in terms of, you know, the presentation. So you know, thank you very much for that. On financial instruments, I worry a little bit that you're out of alignment, you know, with the IASB. Maybe I'm being too generous by saying a little bit. But not only in terms of the concept, but in terms of timing. And I'm worried that you guys might find yourself in a little bit of a box if they get too far ahead of you on some things and maybe force you into an area or into some conclusions that you'd rather not or you wouldn't get to in your left to your own devices.
Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. They don't come too frequently. In terms of financial instruments, I share your concern. Financial instruments is probably the most bothersome project from the standpoint that, given the financial crisis, I believe it was the most important project for the two boards to get on board together with. And it turns out to be the one where we probably have the greatest disconnect. So I think for a myriad of different reasons, it's a poster child for how not to do a convergence project. That being said, as I indicated, we are working hard together on impairment. Whether we get there or how we get there still remains to be seen, but we are, I think both boards have an objective of coming up with a converged solution impairment. At the same time, we recognize that neither of us is willing to sacrifice what either party considers to be the most quality standard. So we have a challenge in front of us. In terms of classification and measurement, the IASB has committed to taking whatever we come up with as our final document and exposing that in some fashion to get put a wraparound, similar to what we did with their proposal on derivatives and hedging activities. We're hopeful that they'll take that and do something with it. Now, the challenge is that thus far they've said, no, IFRS 9 is IFRS 9, and they're not moving off of it. And they've been particularly strong in those comments when it comes to discussing the insurance project, because clearly there are some easy answers you can get on insurance if they were willing to open up IFRS 9, but it remains to be seen as to whether they will do that. But we are hopeful that they'll see what our final package is and that they'll get comments that are positive and perhaps reconsider IFRS 9. In terms of hedging, as we have exposed their proposed document on hedging, which is you have to understand that when it comes to hedging derivatives and hedging activities, we're starting off at different places to begin with. But they've come up with a proposal that we have put a wrap around, and we've put forth a number of specific questions to see how our constituents would respond to their proposal. I suspect that we'll get a lot of positive reaction to their proposal because their proposal is a lot easier to implement than our proposal. But there are a number of problems with it, at least some people think so. And we will take the feedback that we get on that. We will participate in their redeliberations of their exposure draft, and then we'll just see, you know, see how it evolves from there. But, I mean, I understand your point. I find it very disappointing that both organizations, because of various different reasons and pressures on those organizations, were unable to to really deliberate together on a more timely basis. But I think both organizations recognize it, and there's a commitment to at least consider each other's views.
Jamie Miller.
Larry, first I just want to say I also, like Mike, appreciate your comments today, and especially the continued focus on due process and appropriate time to issue quality standards by the board, and just the thoughtful consideration of the issues that you've exhibited over the last several months. Again, reiterating, Mike, the reprioritization that's been undertaken by the FASB and the IASB, I think, has been very helpful to the process. But we discussed last year some of the challenges that will be faced by preparers in digesting the proposed changes, and the same issues will be present for auditors, and I think in some cases they'll be more exacerbated for auditors. You know, preparers will likely have 2 to 3 years of kind of working with data and working with the standards and determining how they should be adopted at the data and transaction level, and I think auditors may be challenged simply because they'll have a more compressed time frame to really audit, challenge, and evaluate that information. And I think it just says that as you consider the transition approach for these standards, we need to be very, very thoughtful about how we do that. And, you know, it goes without saying that understanding investors' needs are very critical in evaluating those transition timeframes and what they should be. But I think it also needs to be balanced by potentially the impacts on other parties. And so when I think about things like a 3-year retrospective, which is, you know, one of the methods being proposed, and compare that with, say, a 1-year retrospective or a prospective adoption approach, you know, a 3-year retrospective could put auditors in a situation where there's potentially a lot of information to audit in a very compressed time frame. I also think some of the other challenges, and this gets to maybe some of Barbara's comments as well, are that it's hard for auditors to really separate use of hindsight versus what judgments companies would have made at the time when establishing financial statement amounts for things like impairments or revenue recognition in long-term contracts. And so while I think that's a challenge for both preparers and auditors, it's certainly very, very complicated, and it's hard if you have a 3-year retrospective implementation. You know, whereas the 1-year retrospective or a prospective, again, just might be more manageable and being more real-time, sort of a focused level of volume and something that people can digest more easily. So it's, to me, it's just an area that requires just continued thoughtful consideration, and I'd be curious as to your comments or thoughts on the time frame for when the FASB would begin publishing or discussing its preliminary thoughts and decisions. I know that was recently deliberated, but, you know, maybe give us a sense as to where you are in the process and what the timing is.
I think we totally appreciate the challenges with respect to retrospective, 3-year retrospective transition method. At the same time, the user community, particularly as it relates to revenue recognition, you know, feels very strongly that some comparative data is necessary. The real issue and question before us is whether 3 years is necessary, 2 years is necessary. 1 year is necessary, or whether we do something similar to some other EITF issues that we've dealt with recently, where we say, okay, if you can't go back in time, maybe you can go forward in time under the old method and show us the differences. So all of those considerations will be on the table when we get to that point. You know, to be perfectly honest, we are so much in the throes of just deliberating the fundamental issues associated with the projects that I think it's a little bit early for us, and those decisions might in turn influence the extent to which people may be able to go back or not. So I think it's a little premature for us for me to commit specifically as to when we're going to debate that. You know, if we hit our timetable, you know, I mean, theoretically we should be debating it, you know, early May at the latest, but so that remains to be seen. But Jamie, you know, I think we're totally aware of the challenges to a retrospective adoption. So we'll be looking at everything possible to A, reduce the cost and frustration of dealing with transition, but B, comply with the informational requirements of users.
Okay, thanks. And Jamie, some of those issues you raised we'll be talking about in the SAG discussion topics shortly. Damon Silvers?
Larry, I have two questions for you. One is, and I don't think you've been here for these discussions, but I have noted frequently at this meeting, in this body, that in my other capacity on the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP, we endeavored to try to identify more than a year ago TARP stands for Troubled Asset Relief Program. We attempted to identify the extent and value of troubled assets on the balance sheets of publicly traded financial institutions using GAAP financials as our primary method, and found that it could not be done. That conclusion is in the panel's August 2009 oversight report. It certainly limited our capacity to do oversight. The fact that we couldn't identify, that is in charge with the oversight of troubled assets, we couldn't identify how many there were at public companies. Of course, we had a budget from Congress and a staff of 30 people who basically were only focused on this question and still could not answer it. I'm curious about what, if any, conclusions FASB draws from that set of circumstances about the current state of the GAAP framework. And then secondly, I noted your comment about contingent liabilities, that the board was perhaps rethinking that initiative. there's a whole lot of big important issues about contingent liabilities out there right now. And I'm curious, does the board view, or did the board before the meeting you referred to think of contingent think that there was a single framework for contingent liabilities? I believe that was the import of the release that you took up. And do you now have a different view, or what exactly is the board's or your current view? I know you may not be able to speak for the board. What exactly is your current view of the question of, is there a single framework for contingent liabilities? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that is.
Okay, so since it's fresher on my mind, I'll respond to the second question first.
That's fine.
We have not changed our mind with respect to disclosure of contingencies. What we've done is we've put it on hold to evaluate whether some of the actions by the SEC in terms of their Dear CFO type letters has resulted in a perceived change in how contingencies are being disclosed, what's being disclosed, et cetera. to enable us to decide whether we think there is an issue that needs to be addressed or whether there is not. The difficulty that we've had in dealing with disclosures of contingencies in general has been basically lawyers' reluctance to disclose certain things that they believe will hurt their case. And it is an understandable position on the part of lawyers. And there are specific requirements right now in FAS 5 regarding contingencies, and we want to see whether those disclosures have improved, and then make a determination as to whether they should be improved further, and if so, to what degree. So we have not made any decisions specifically one way or another. We're in a holding pattern, you know, waiting to see what happens.
Is it? Do I understand it rightly from your answer that your view and perhaps the board's view is that there is a single sort of conceptual framework for dealing with when a contingent liability needs to be disclosed and the scale of that liability, and that it's embodied in FAS 5 currently, and that you're anticipating perhaps adjusting that, but you think there is such a thing as a single conceptual framework for this issue?
Okay, well, I wouldn't use the term conceptual framework, but
use a term you'd like.
I believe there is a specific requirement as to what should be disclosed in the financial statements for contingencies, and really the purpose of our project on contingencies was to address issues regarding the implementation of the requirements under FAS 5.
Right. So your view continues to be that there should be one set of principles governing all contingencies.
That is not my position. Okay, that the decision we made related to that project was to relate it to FAS 5 contingencies. Okay, it was not a reconsideration of contingency disclosures in general, and we have not addressed that whatsoever. We've done no staff research to enable me to respond to your question.
I mean, I think it's extremely important in terms of the credibility of FASB generally that there be some consistency on this point. That there not be one set of rules for politically connected contingencies and another set of rules for non-politically connected contingencies. And I'd appreciate it if you answered my other question.
Okay. What was your question again? It was what have we done to address the fact that there were TARP assets that you could not find or could not value?
I find it surprising that you couldn't follow me, but let me try it again.
I'm sorry, Damon. You know, I'm sitting here trying to respond to your question.
No, I understand. It's just that this question has preoccupied the entire country for 4 years, and I'm not sure why it's so hard for you to follow, but let me try it again. So there are these things called troubled assets. Perhaps you've heard of them. They are not TARP assets. They are the troubled assets on the balance sheets of TARP recipient institutions. Many of them have something to do with home mortgages. The firms involved are firms that file GAAP accounting statements. When our oversight panel, with its staff of 30 people, solely devoted to this question, tried to determine, using GAAP financial statements, what troubled assets were on the balance sheets of publicly traded firms, and this was again in the summer of 2009, our staff could not answer the question. We could not answer the question of how many such troubled assets were there. And after all, we're talking about a body impaneled under something called the Troubled Asset Relief Program established by the Congress of the United States. We couldn't answer the question. Now, that my question to you is, what does FASB conclude from the fact that you can't answer that question under GAAP?
Okay, we have specific disclosure requirements with respect to marketable securities, et cetera, which compares both fair value to cost basis and also the extent to which there's delinquencies. So we have some specific disclosures. Now, as to the identification of what you're considering to be troubled assets, we have not put on a project specifically to try to define those.
Let me put it a different way. Is it that our staff is incompetent? Is it that Congress?
I don't know specifically what you were doing, okay, in terms of identifying them and what your objectives were. So I can't respond to that question. I can't. Right.
Okay, in the interest of time, I think we need to move on. The question's been asked and answered.
I'd like to remind him that I was acting on behalf of the Congress of the United States to determine what had happened and whether the objectives of the $700 billion TARP program had been achieved. And that ought to be of some concern, the fact that we could not use the statements prepared under your rules to answer those questions ought to be of some concern to the FASB.
Larry, thanks. Joe Carcella.
Larry, one comment and one question. I apologize for my voice. I think it's the springtime analogies are so great. In response to one of Damon's questions on the contingency issue, and you indicated that you're in somewhat of a wait-and-see mode to see how effective the SEC's Dear CFO letters are. And here's the comment. I would suggest for you to consider the fact that you're largely dependent on, when a CFO gets that letter, presumably came from the chief accountant, it's going to get their attention. And not all chief accountants are going to focus on that issue with equal vigilance. And so 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, when there's a new chief accountant or priorities have changed, it's very possible that behavior reverts to what it was before the Dear CFO letters. So I don't know if that's a substitute for standards, I guess is my point, for you to at least consider. The question, as I heard you talk about consolidation, in the U.S. under FASB standards, we're using a majority vote rule, and under IFRS or IASB standards, we're using effective control. That strikes me, and maybe you can illuminate this for me, Larry, as a really big difference, or potentially a really big difference. And so my sense would be under IFRS we'll see a lot more consolidations, whereas comparable companies in the U.S. would presumably be accounting for a similar type sub using the equity method, which will give you very, very different, as you know even better than I, income statements and balance sheets. And so I guess my question would be, A, am I wrong? And if I'm not wrong, to what extent, if any, will note disclosures be able to enable analysts and other users to essentially reconstruct the alternative hypothesis, if you will?
You're not wrong theoretically. Okay, as I understand it, anecdotally, there are many IFRS reporting entities or countries where they might actually, even though they currently have the effect, because right now they have the effective control rule as well, that many times they look to U.S. GAAP for guidance in terms of how to evaluate that. That being the case, I understand, and I believe it's particularly in France, that there are companies that are consolidating other companies when they do not have voting control, when they have effective control, so let's say 45% or something like that. So in those instances, you are going to have differences in reporting, and I'm not totally familiar with their disclosure requirements in terms of, you know, specifically if they have to say whether they have less than a majority, so I apologize. But I think I don't think the difference is quite, from a practical standpoint, is quite as great as you believe it is, just because of the way people are applying IFRS right now. And this is what I'm being told anecdotally from talking to the staff, primarily from the staff of the IASB.
Larry, I just want to interject for a second on a point that Joe Carcello was making and actually came up earlier as well. I think it's a very important issue, this the matter of contingencies and obvious loss contingencies, and obviously the board does too by your efforts to put out some exposure drafts in that area. And I think the point Joe was making, that the Dear CFO letters will certainly highlight a particular area where maybe disclosures will be improved in that area because of the SEC being on top of that issue and sending out those kind of letters. But I think the question continues to exist, and if I understand it correctly, I think the board has kind of asked the SEC through CorpFin and maybe PCOB through our inspections, is the problem with loss contingency disclosures, especially around those that aren't probable but reasonably possible, is this really an accounting standards problem, or is it a compliance and enforcement issue? And are the existing standards workable, but there's just companies are not eager to lay out reasonably possible losses if they think that they can avoid that. And so therefore, is there a compliance and enforcement issue there? Is that a question that I think the board's kind of asked us to think about, both CorpFin and PCOB?
Definitely. I mean, there are, when we've struggled with the issue in terms of coming up with a proposed standard, you know, we've asked ourselves and you know, we've talked about it amongst the PCOB and the SEC as to whether this is a compliance issue or whether it's a standards issue. And that's why we're looking forward to seeing the results of the Dear CFO letter.
Galen Hansen.
Larry, like others, I'd like to express thanks for being willing to come and run the gauntlet here with us this morning. I mean, I would like to change maybe the direction of some of what I was talking to you about a little bit earlier this morning, and that is whether or not the constituency that you have got feedback on this process, and I look at this is the timing and where are we going with this in the short term? And in looking through the comment letters that came back to the FASB, we just really didn't see a lot from the smaller companies. We didn't see virtually anything from smaller firms out of the 120 comment letters. And I guess I'm real concerned about that we're operating in somewhat of a vacuum. And I'm not sure why that was. I don't know I know that people have high demands on their times. They have the resources and ability to respond to such complex matters in a short period of time. I don't know if that word got out there sufficiently well enough. But hopefully you're going to get some additional feedback on that. You know, in particular, Arnie raised the question about resources. The big four firms have the ability to address some of these things. That, you know, how does that happen with small and medium-sized firms or preparers for that matter? And that time frame that Jamie Miller was talking about, that compressed time frame, you know, the larger firms are out at the big companies virtually all year round. For the smaller businesses, that is even more compressed, where they're out there during a period of a month or two or even weeks on some occasions. So I would get real concerned with that. The other thing is I'm not sure that the complexity on these standards are the same for all preparers, and I'm talking in very broad terms. The smaller companies, some of these are actually, I think, in some sense, more complex for the smaller companies than they are larger ones. By that I mean the smaller companies that are doing complex equity transactions with embedded derivatives, unconvertible debt, or debentures, preferred stock issues that larger companies are not having to deal with on a regular basis. So, you know, I'm in terms of the feedback and in terms of the issues that you're dealing with, I think you're only getting a partial view. So, and then we have this whole initiative on looking at private GAAP. Where does that fit in to this? I'm glad to see, especially on the derivatives issue, that we're going to give that a little bit longer. What, a four-year delay on the private side to deal with some of these things? Or there's a timing differential somewhere in here for some of that. But I'd be interested to hear what your comments might be on that.
Yeah, we recognize the fact that we did not receive much formal feedback in terms of letters from smaller companies. And we have a separate outreach endeavor to try to appropriately evaluate the challenges and the timing for smaller companies. So we will be reaching out to the smaller companies and using some of our resource committees to appropriately evaluate that. In terms of the, you mentioned derivatives, but I think you meant classification and measurement. That's where we provided smaller companies with a four-year window to implement the standard. I would venture to say that some of the decisions we've made in terms of classification and measurement in redeliberations might influence our decision or the length of time over which we might consider delaying implementation for smaller entities for that particular standard. The concerns specifically for those smaller institutions with respect to the exposure draft was that we were requiring fair value of loans on the balance sheet, and we thought that smaller companies needed more time to get their systems in place and to educate themselves as to what they needed to do, as well as to watch what the larger companies were doing. We've since changed our model in redeliberation such that the expectation, at least from my standpoint, would be that many more loans would be recorded at amortized cost as opposed to fair value, and therefore the implementation difficulties that existed with the exposure draft should not be as great for the if we finalize the decisions we've made to date. So that will influence our thinking on that. But that being said, you know, I at least within the last couple of years, few years, we've tended with respect to private companies to give them an extra delay. And one of the primary concerns with private companies is that their primary education system revolves around educating during the summer. So effectively, we need to consider their educational cycle with respect to implementation dates. You know, there's been no significant change in that, so I think we would continue to evaluate that. The real question is it the private-public split that's the appropriate split in terms of delaying implementation, or should there be a large public, small public split? That is a very tough issue from our standpoint. You know, there's one school of thought that says smaller companies do not have the resources of larger companies, so therefore they need more time. There's another school of thought that says if you're a public company, you're a public company, and therefore you ought to be have the same timing requirements. And those are things that we need to consider.
In the interest of time, we have 5 tent cards up. We'll take those remaining questions, and then we'll break for lunch. Next, Nary Books fan.
Thank you. An observation and a question. I'll start with the question because it's probably simpler. We will be discussing disclosure framework, and some discussion on disclosure were made earlier. It would be useful to actually give us some insights of notwithstanding timing. what the board plans to take up in this project and what's expected to play out, because I think it's going to incite our discussion in the afternoon. The second observation is more broad. It goes to some comments I made in this forum probably a year ago, which is very consistent with some of the elements we discussed today. For me as a user, what I think about financial statements, it serves two purposes. One is needs to provide useful information with utility to the users, being them whatever they, whoever they are. And two, there has to be some notion of reliability to it, which is the element of what this board is doing. I think sometimes those elements are intertwined. Because of reliability issues, you have some issues of relevance. But I think the session that Bob Hertz has in his last in his speech to the AAA conference, he was asked whether there was a single project that he regrets from not taking up earlier. And the topic that he mentioned was conceptual framework. Interestingly enough, I'm sitting on both the advisory board for the International Accounting Standard Board and the FASB. Both of those advisory boards have been very consistent now in yearning for the very same thing. And what I'm hearing here this morning is very similar desires from people here with respect to what disclosures should tell the users, what should disclosure even be consistent for contingencies and something else. And my observation is more an observation of priority, and I recognize what your agenda is now and what you need to do by June 30th. But what I think is incumbent on perhaps all of us and other participants to think what we're doing after June 30th, because those, in my mind, are quite serious and significant issues, even if you just replay the tape from the last 30 minutes. I would also suggest, and again, I've raised two anecdotal observations. One is the liabilities and equity, and one is leases. For example, the topic of leases was not mentioned in your discussion, and now the boards are rethinking, introducing some notions such as operating lease. The notion of consolidation discussed 49% or 50%. I would venture to say that those issues are not new. They have nothing to do with financial crisis. Leases have always been there, and people are struggling and grappling with the very same issues. Which gets me to, again, a very simple observation. The reason that I think some of those issues are not being resolved is not because there's no one right answer, because there are more than one right answer. And some of the comments you're going to get, whether it's 60-40 or 50-60 or 70-30, are associated with comments that people are raising very good issues. The problem that we have is the difficulties to reconcile it to a mothership, to a concept, to something we are always familiar with. If you don't have it, whether you have it for auditing or accounting, you are in an environment that everybody is right, and it's very difficult to resolve the issues, which gets me to the issue of priorities. And I would venture to say that, you know, perhaps leasing or consolidation should not be priority, but rather conceptual framework would. I'd like to get your observation on both.
I listen with interest about what you said about the conceptual framework. And I've listened to the discussion at the last FASAC meeting that we had where a number of people expressed the same views. And I guess I have a little different view. And these clearly are my views. People talk as if we don't have a conceptual framework. That is not true. Okay, we definitely have a conceptual framework. And if you saw some of the amendments that we've worked on, that the two boards have agreed on in terms of definitions of assets and liabilities, et cetera, the changes aren't all that earth-shattering, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the boards have said, let's put this, you know, some of these discussions on the back burner. That being said, there are parts of our conceptual framework that are in need of something. We don't have anything. Probably the primary one that comes to mind is the measurement basis. You know, what is an appropriate measurement basis? What should we look to guide people to assess whether a cost is more appropriate in one circumstance versus a fair value in another circumstance? And while we don't have a conceptual framework with respect to measurement basis right now, although we are working on it, we do have other aspects of our conceptual framework that the board members can look to. You know, the qualitative characteristic of financial statements and and how you assess those are directly related to the conceptual framework that I think we would develop with respect to the measurement basis. So, you know, I guess, Neri, my reaction to what you said is I don't think having taking our conceptual framework and evolving it to a higher state, to a more improved state, will necessarily provide us with the answers to the leasing questions that we have right now. I think we'll still have differences of opinion among people, even if you apply a more robust conceptual framework with respect to those issues. I'm not saying that we should not strive. I think we need to, particularly when it relates to the measurement basis, we need to establish that. And we need some type of a framework for disclosure. The project that we have right now is a very broad project on disclosure framework and what we should have in it. As you know, I mean, ITAC came up with a proposal a couple of years ago as to what things should be a minimum, and some of those things are being considered with respect to the conceptual framework project the disclosure framework project that we have. Additionally, as a part of that project, we'll be looking at the existing disclosures that we have and whether there are disclosure-specific requirements or general requirements that should be removed in light of the fact that we've now agreed to add X, Y, and Z, whatever we agree to. So our disclosure framework project is a very broad project. Whether it becomes a standard or a framework is still a question in my mind. Right now it's being proposed as a standard project. I'm having difficulty understanding why it's a standard project as opposed to a conceptual framework project, but that I don't think that's that important.
I can do it here next Penn, but there's given it a five other cards. I don't want to take more than my allotted time, so we can do it offline, but I do think it's a conceptual framework issue. I'll work with it separately.
Thanks. If Sam Ranzilla?
Larry, I don't have a question. Just an observation first. Let me just say from this member of the SAG that I am very supportive of the work that you've been doing and your board and the way you're going about your due process through the convergence process. So, but here's the observation. As you look to the retrospective versus prospective, maybe limited retrospective, I think it's important to coordinate very closely with the SEC around the retrospective treatment. Jamie made reference to a three-year retrospective. Because of the five-year table under selected financial data, there's at least some views that have been expressed that a retrospective application of a standard is a five-year retrospective. That is, speaking just for myself, the cost of going back into fourth and fifth years simply doesn't seem to warrant any benefit. And in fact, maybe I'll take this opportunity to ask the SEC, not for this forum, but should we reconsider whether or not the five-year table has actually outlived its usefulness to begin with. To the extent that it hasn't, it sure seems to me that on a retrospective application, going back 5 years is excessive. So I'm not looking for – that's not a question, but just an observation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Doug Carmichael?
Concerned with the auditability of revenue recognition, there are some business arrangements and some industries that are very susceptible to earnings management revenue misstatement. And I wonder what kind of, an outstanding example would be software vendors, where the criteria for revenue recognition have been developed in response to abuses in the past. What kind of discussions have you had about the implications of making that guidance more subjective, fewer kinds of tests than an auditor can readily apply for the quality of audited financial statements and the credibility of the process?
I believe the subjectivity or auditability of revenue has been at the forefront of many board members' minds through the discussions. As I alluded to earlier, yesterday we spent 4 hours discussing variable contingent arrangements in connection with revenue transactions and how they should be accounted for. And there are differences of views, but I think there are a number of board members who would like to see a specific hurdle that would have to be met or surpassed in order to allow somebody to recognize revenue. There are other board members that don't share that view, that believe that, you know, you should be able to make an estimate and live by that estimate and then make changes as you obtain information to cause you to believe that that estimate should be changed. But so that was part of the difficulty we were dealing with yesterday. Specifically as it relates to software, I guess there's different feedback that we receive. Some of the feedback is that the rules that were written for software were written probably when the software industry was kind of at its early phases, and therefore there was a great need for that type of robust, specific guidance. I think as time has evolved, people are feeling more comfortable with people's ability to evaluate software revenue recognition methodology such that a specific environment or requirement like 97.2 is no longer necessary. And clearly, I think through the feedback we've received on our exposure draft, people are feeling that while there might be certain circumstances where things are more difficult to estimate, I think people are feeling comfortable or more comfortable that you'd be able to apply the provisions within our revised set of decisions that we've made in redeliberation. So, you know, I think we've put enough in terms of what people should be looking at to come up with how a transaction price ought to be allocated to the various components to enable people to apply it without something like 97.2.
Chef Mahoney.
Thank you. Larry, a couple things. One, there were several comments on retrospective application. And I think you've received some input indicating that maybe one way to reduce the cost is to push ahead of the effective date, so that would encompass some one or more of the retrospective years. So I'd encourage the board to consider that as an alternative. The second item, I wanted to get your thoughts on this notion of a big bang. And what, in your view, that encompasses? Your list of joint projects shows 10 projects, and then you have a number of FASB-only projects. So I assume not all 10 of those could be part of a big bang, since some of them, earliest they could be done would be 2013 per your website. So those wouldn't be part of a big bang. So I assume the big bang's smaller than that. But then there are these other very major projects that are outside of the big bang. So does that mean there would be like a second big bang following the first big bang? I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, and then there is also a decision that the SEC might give some indication as to where we're headed in terms of IFRS as a whole. So that's another thing to throw into the equation. obviously, we just have to talk to more people and come up with different alternatives. I think there are a number of arguments that a big bang would be almost impossible to implement in the U.S. because there wouldn't be enough people in order to provide the expertise and spread it amongst the various companies that would have to implement the various standards, to the extent that there's, you know, particular software or consulting needs of organizations. So we have not yet held any roundtables to discuss the effective dates and the transition methods, and clearly they'll be a part of those discussions. But, you know, as to my specific reaction, you know, I don't think it really matters. I think we still have to go through the process more.
And Arnie Hainish has the last question, then we'll all wrap up and we'll break for lunch.
I will try to keep it brief then. One observation and really more clarification on a second point. From a retrospective approach, again, maybe just to build upon some of the comments, from a preparer's perspective, anything we can do to avoid, in my view, a retrospective approach would be positive. I think if I look at the briefing paper on page 7, you know, where you talk about revenue recognition being one that would be a retrospective approach, I just fathom the challenges, extreme challenges, both from an auditing standpoint as well as just a company's standpoint, to go back 3 years or maybe 5 years if it's required with regard to the supplemental information, to go back and with millions of transactions from a revenue recognition perspective across 100 different affiliates in multiple countries, where you don't really have the systems in place to deal with these issues, the complexities would be extremely excruciating. And so, I guess using that one as an example, I would certainly suggest that there would be some reconsideration there, and try to avoid retrospective application where at all possible. I think the other one, Larry, is more of a clarification. You made the comment, at least if I wrote it correctly, that loss contingencies was put on the back burner, and then there was some dialogue sort of in the end here between you and Marty around maybe a mandate that PCOB has to look at some issues around loss contingencies as part of their inspections. I mean, my perspective is that we really need to give the SEC time to work out their reviews of financial statements and have the dialogue with individual companies that they think are not providing appropriate disclosures around loss contingencies, and to let them deal with it with the registrants, as opposed to having the FASB bring this issue back on the front burner. So I hope it stays on the back burner. I think that this is a extremely contentious issue relative to both with lawyers as well as the preparers, and may not be in the best interest of the investors. The complexities around loss contingencies and the dynamics that evolve as you're going through a negotiation or even trying to determine whether you're going to have a settlement strategy or whether you're going to go to court, and then to have to disclose ranges of outcomes in financial statements prematurely put all of us at a disadvantage against the plaintiff's bar, and I think is not in the best interest of our investors. And so I think it is best dealt through individual dialogue between the SEC and the registrant, if the SEC believes that the current disclosures that are presented within financial statements are inappropriate. I know we spend a significant amount of time agonizing over our disclosures to make sure that they are robust enough to give the reader at least an idea as to where we stand with respect to the numerous pieces of litigation that we have along the continuum. But it's an incredible amount of time that's spent with inside counsel, outside counsel. But if the SEC has any, takes exception, then we're more than willing to engage in the dialogue. But to date, even with ours, and the significant amount of litigation that we've had over the years, the SEC has not raised any of those issues with regard to the disclosures that we've presented in the past. So.
I don't think there's a mandate for the PCOB there, but I think what we were saying before was that FASB had asked the SEC, CorpFin, and us through our inspection and CorpFin through their efforts, what are their compliance issues with respect to disclosures on contingencies to help inform their thinking. But I appreciate your points. I think there is one more card up, and we will take that, and then we finally let Larry off the hook and we'll break for lunch. Thanks, John.
Yeah, on the contingencies point, I guess being somewhat on the front lines of it as a lawyer, it does appear that CorpFin is very actively looking at this from a compliance perspective. And, you know, CorpFin sends out about 4,000-plus comment letters every year. And they are, let me just say, actively asking these questions. And I recently looked at the 10-Ks for five of the largest financial institutions, the 2010 10-Ks, and compared them to the 2009 10-Ks. And in all five, you saw for the first time a number in there for reasonably possible losses, you know, in billions of dollars in each one of them. So, I mean, the disclosures are changing. Now, whether they're getting, you know, to where FASB wants them or where the SEC wants them, I won't speak to that, but there clearly are changes occurring out there. I mean, this is a real effort, apparently, by Brian and his colleagues, and there are some results coming out of it. I guess just one other observation. I guess I can't hold myself back on this one, but you know, if you go back to the crisis atmosphere we were in the fall of 2008, when Congress put out a bill or passed a law over a couple of weeks of work, and defined a new regulatory term that we'd never seen. Let me just say, it doesn't surprise me that a term that was not in GAAP. It doesn't surprise me that you can't look at GAAP financials and, you know, find the answer on troubled assets.
John, thank you for your comment. With that, I wanted to wrap up. I know on some of the in the questions through Larry, many of the discussion topics were answered. If there's things that you'd like to share with the PCOB staff on audit implications from these joint standards, you can feel free to reach out to us. But I do want to thank Larry Smith for coming, and not only Larry, but the other members of the FASB and the staff always make themselves available to join us in a forum like this, particularly when everyone at the FASB seems to be drinking from a fire hose with everything they have. So thank you, Larry, and we'll break for lunch.